Bar. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With inspectors shaking down Saddam's palaces, suicide bombings in Mombasa, and bin Laden beaming his messages over Al Jazeera, it's easy to forget that in the days after September 11th, the Arab world felt America's pain. Quote, the destruction of America is the destruction of the human dream across the world, unquote, the influential Arabic daily Al Hayat wrote on September 19th. But more than a year later, sympathy and fellow feeling are vanishing commodities, and the threat of terrorism seems more urgent than ever. My guest tonight says Washington's war on terror isn't working. The U.S. could take out Osama, dismantle al-Qaeda, and even defeat Iraq, but coercive force won't eliminate the Islamic terrorist threat, says Shibli Telhami. The renowned political scientist and author says Washington is riding roughshod over real possibilities for peace and betting everything on fierce power projection. It's a bad bet, says Telhami, and it threatens to bring on a terrible clash of civilizations that is not necessary. Do you buy it? Is the war on terror on the wrong road? If the U.S. simmers down and takes the moral high road, will it be a sucker or a winner? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Shibli Telhami. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. And his new book is The Stakes, America and the Middle East, The Consequences of Power and the Choice for Peace. Good evening and welcome, Shibli Telhami.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you with us. Thanks so much for being back on point. Shibli Telhami, let's get right down to basics here. You describe in the book, and it's very eye-opening, provocative book, a situation in which the United States and much of the Middle East do not define, even define, terrorism in the same terms. What's the distinction you see there?
Well, there are a number of issues, and I don't think it's just a difference between the U.S. and the Middle East. I think it's a difference between the U.S. and much of the world on the view of terrorism.
All right.
I think for a very good reason. Obviously, we have we're examining and looking at the terror phenomenon globally through the prism of 9/11, mm-hmm. and that's understandable. It's a very profoundly emotional issue for us. But much of the world really sees terrorism not so much as an ideology, not so much as a political movement, but as a horrific instrument, a method employed by different groups for different ends, and that in order to defeat it, you can't just confront those who carry it out, but you need to delegitimize it. You need to essentially persuade societies that are hospitable to it, that it's an illegitimate means. And therefore, just as you must confront the merchants of terror, the merchants of death, and there are some who must be confronted, like mm-hmm. al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. you must also seek to delegitimize the phenomenon in the eyes of the vast majority of the people who are hospitable to it for reasons that are not necessarily the same as those who drive those terrorists who conduct the terror attacks.
And we'll talk about that. But you say that the United States started out with a pretty good response to 9/11, but then it went south. It got off the rails. Where did you see it going well? Where do you see it as having gone off course?
Well, there are two issues. The primary issue is that we really had two missions, and we confused both. One mission is responding to the attack on 9/11. It is an American right to respond to such a horrific attack. It doesn't matter whether it's terror or not. It doesn't matter who conducted it. It was a horrific attack. No one can deny America the right to respond. And therefore, the war in Afghanistan, the battle against the Taliban regime, which was hosting al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. Was certainly one that I think much of the world sympathized with. Even those who may have wanted to see more proof indicating that the Taliban was involved, some questioned it. I think it's wrong. I think the proof was there. And I think that much of the world understood that America had to respond. No power can leave that without response, and certainly not a superpower.
So everyone's on the same page there.
Yes. I think, was a – I supported mm-hmm. – that effort. I think that was a necessary response. I'm not a pacifist.
All right.
I come from realist roots. I understand that power has to be used, but it has to be used prudently. I think the second mission is our mission to fight what we call global terrorism, beyond al-Qaeda. There, I think, we have sought to address issues that are more vital to other countries and regions than to us. And we wanted to define both the priorities for the globe and the way to address the threats that emanate from regions like the Middle East and elsewhere. And there, I think, we lost much of the moral high ground, because on issues like terrorism in the Middle East, the regional terrorism, whether it's on the Palestinian-Israeli front or elsewhere, these issues are very vital to parties in the Middle East. And they have to play a role in defining the issue and in addressing the means agreeing on the means to respond to them.
Shibletul, I'm not sure I'm following you here, Shibletul. I mean, are you saying that there are conflicts that we can't deny, where we can't ask people to sit down and be quiet in the interest of our war on terror, where there's going to be violence, whether the United States likes it or not? Is that what you're saying, that we're painting everybody with one brush?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I think the issue of terrorism globally, beyond the attack on us, is an issue that affects everyone else, that we have to do it collectively with the rest of the world. Because on that issue, the broader question of what priority should the international community focus on, which terrorist groups to take on first, how to delegitimize it in international eyes, that's an issue that really belongs to the entire international community. Let me give you an example for example, choosing our priority next, which is Iraq, mm-hmm. which we define as part of our war on terrorism.
The axis of evil.
Yes. And if you look at that effort, it's our right, first of all, to decide who our enemies are and mm-hmm. to confront Iraq as an enemy state. The question of going at it through getting international support, Iraq is vitally important. What happens in Iraq is vitally important to almost all its neighbors, to Saudi Arabia, to Syria, to Jordan, to Iran, certainly to Israel. And for them, Iraq is even a more vital issue than it is to us. And we therefore cannot persuade them to jump on our winning bandwagon if we don't take the vital interests into account. So the issue here is that when the question is not directly linked to the attack on our soil, it becomes not only our issue but everybody's issue, and therefore everybody else wants to play a role.
And so far, you're saying that we haven't been sharing in that conversation sufficiently, perhaps. You describe a situation in which coercive force comes to the fore in response to terror, and you say that there are real limits to the utility of coercive force, and that if you lean on it too hard, you're going to go right off a cliff. Are we leaning on it too hard?
Well, on the terrorist issue, I think there is a supply and there is a demand side. The supply side, it's these horrible people who carry out attacks and organize, like al-Qaeda. I think they must be confronted. I think that part is right. But then there is what I call the demand side. The fact is that these groups appeal to a broader audience, and they're able to recruit members to join them. They're able to appeal to public opinion. They're able to draw finances. And the question is why? What is this broader regional environment that allows them to draw recruits and to get financial support and to get public opinion on their side? That is what I call the demand side. And the demand side, I think, is connected to conditions that make it easier for these groups to recruit. And those conditions, I think, are first and foremost hopelessness and humiliation. I think humiliation is a term that I use deliberately, because I think it explains the psychology of the demand side even more than poverty. And I think in the Middle Eastern arena, when you look at the relationship between much of the Arab world, at least, and the West, and the United States in particular, you find that it is mostly over a sense of collective humiliation, in large part connected to the Arab-Israeli issue, but not only to that, also to the fact that you have authoritarian governments in the region that have been historically supported by the U.S.
We'll talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict, but I want to go to this larger issue first, because in the United States, in the months and now a year plus since 9/11, increasingly it seems to me that the critique has been shifted to the point where now it's seen as maybe your clash of civilizations, your clash of values, not a clash of policies, but people saying the Middle East, the Islamic world is simply opposed to modernity. They hate us for what we are. It makes the clash seem inevitable. What's your view?
Well, that's actually a very good question, because I think in a way we are on a slippery slope where we may end up with a clash of civilization that is detrimental to everyone. I don't think the clash and the disagreements and the resentment of America, resentment of people in the Middle East toward the United States are driven by values. They're ultimately driven by policies. Let me address this issue directly. Mm-hmm. I do think that there are people in the region who do hate America for what America stands for. They've always been people who reject Western values, reject what America stands for. And perhaps Al-Qaeda and its core supporters are of that mind. They're not only objecting to American policies, but really objecting to America's way of life. They want a different political order.
How strong, but how widespread is that view?
That is not the widespread view in the Arab and Muslim world. We know that through surveys. We know that historically. Historically, the U.S. has not always been hated. On the contrary, the U.S. has historically been at various stages rather loved, particularly in the early 20th century. France was at once hated because of its policies in the region. France now gets mostly favorable ratings in the Middle East, even though France, of course, is part of the Western world. Mm-hmm. It is about policies. I've done surveys in the region. And in one instance, I asked specifically, are your resentments toward the United States mostly based on its policies or mostly based on its values, mm-hmm. especially in Saudi Arabia? And the vast majority of the people, both elites and the general public, said that it's mostly based on policies, not based on values. We've had a lot of other indicators, and much of the survey analysis conducted by Gallup, that conducted by the Zogby International, all showed that the focus is largely on policies, not on values. And even on values, where there are certain aspects certainly that people do not agree with and do not like about America, most of those, when you ask them, have to do with actual misperceptions. For example, they view America as not valuing family life. Mm-hmm. They view America as not valuing religion. Two things that really are in conflict with the way Americans perceive themselves. They see American values largely through prism of Hollywood movies, very narrow prism. And what they see, they don't like, for sure. But they also have even on the issue of values, there are many things that they like. When you ask them about American freedom, they like that. It gets very high approval ratings in much of the Arab and Muslim countries. So the issue of values, even those people who criticize the U.S., many of them aspire to coming to America to have American freedom. Many of them want to send their kids to come to school in America.
And yet here we are 14, 15 months after 9/11, and people are talking about a potential clash of civilizations. If there's such support, why have we found ourselves in this position?
Exactly. And I think the real problem at the moment is that we found ourselves on a policy track and a track of policy on the Arab side. It's not only America that is at fault here. Clearly, countries in the region have been part of the problem in the way they've been behaving and addressing this issue. But the framing of the question, the discourse today in America has increasingly shifted to seeing Islam and Arabs as a core of the problem. And in the Middle East, you see increasingly a shift in the direction of seeing America as the enemy. And I think that is a truly profound problem. I think in that regard, if you ask yourself the following question, after a year and a half of fighting the war on terrorism, Is there more resentment today toward the United States or less?
And your answer is more. Shibley Tahani, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back to talk about this. We're rethinking the American response to terrorism tonight. Are we going down the wrong path? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're rethinking the American response to terrorism tonight with Shibley Tahani. He's Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and out with a very provocative new book entitled The Stakes, America and the Middle East, The Consequences of Power and the Choice for Peace. You can join the conversation tonight. Are we relying too much on coercive force in the war on terror? Do you agree with Shibley Tahani that it's all about conflicting policies, not conflicting values? And is America sustaining the moral authority to say who's a terrorist and who's not? Or is this a kind of blame America first critique? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shibley Tahani, you're saying just before the break that it's not fundamentally or doesn't need to be about values, that there's enough common ground here between the Islamic world and the United States to work with, and historically there's proof of that, that it's about policies. So tick off the top policies that you see as being at the root of the terror threat, and how ought the United States to change its position on those.
Well, when you look at it, you see that America is seen as the anchor of a regional system that is disadvantageous to the public. And that regional system includes many things. It includes foreign policy issues, particularly the Arab-Israeli issue, the Iraq issue. But it also includes an authoritarian system that has not served its people very well, economically or politically. And they see America as the anchor of that political system.
Is that really the case? We haven't been in the streets like you have. Is it the case in Saudi Arabia, let's say, that when people are upset with their government, they say it's America's fault? In Syria, when they don't like the government, they say it's America's fault?
Well, let me just put it differently. I was getting to another point, really, mm-hmm. and that is that while that is true, that it's all of these, including governments. They don't say it in the street, but certainly a lot of them individually blamed America for the order that existed. They may not blame their governments directly, but the entire political order. But there is no issue. There is no issue that is more important in the psyche of the region and the approach and image of America in the region than the Arab-Israeli issue. That is clearly the prism through which much of the Middle East sees America. When I was in the region last month, spent 2 weeks in several countries, and my critique constantly in every forum I spoke, and I spoke on many fora, including universities and youth organizations and media outlets, and every single issue that came up was seen through the prism of the Arab-Israeli issue. And I actually said it with a criticism to the public there. I said, you blame America for looking at the Middle East only through the prism of terrorism.
Don't be obsessed with this one.
Don't be obsessed only with America is not only the Arab-Israeli issue and not only, you must not look at it only through that prism. But nonetheless, the reality is that they look at it through that prism for a variety of reasons.
I don't want to assume that we know those reasons tonight, but I know you're intimately familiar with that situation. You were born and raised in a village near Haifa. I guess your family was a Christian family, but you know that state of Israel and the conditions in and around Israel very well. What's the heart of the critique here? What's the heart of the complaint in the Islamic world now?
Well, let me say this. Ultimately, they see America as empowering Israel. And when the more tension on the Arab-Israeli conflict there is, the more America is blamed, especially when Arabs are on the losing side, as they are in the Palestinian-Israeli case. So the blame, you know, transfers from Israel to the U.S. whenever there is intense conflict and Arab suffering.
But America looks over and very often sees blame on both sides.
And there's no question about the history of the Arab-Israeli issue, but from the Arab point of view, when you're looking at it through the prism of people who are looking at their own victims. I mean, Israelis look at their own victims, understandably. They have victims of suicide bombings. They look at the conflict through the prism of their own pain. Arabs look at the conflict through the prism of their own pain. And when they look at their media today, which is a very different media from the one that prevailed a decade ago, mm-hmm. much freer, much more transnational, covers more live what happens on the ground. When they see
and
the
filled with images of Palestinian suffering.
Palestinian deaths and destruction mm-hmm. and suffering, they certainly, and they seem helpless, and that is the issue. They seem utterly helpless in doing anything about it, and they see their governments utterly helpless in doing anything about it. And in that regard, they blame America for empowering Israel. I mean, that's one issue. But I think more profoundly, I think we have to understand the importance of this issue psychologically in the region. I think for half a cent, it's not that people care so much about Palestinians individually or even Yasser Arafat. I think he's not especially popular, mm-hmm. frankly, mm-hmm. in the Arab world. And we've seen that in surveys. I think the issue is that the Palestinian issue has become a question of identity for most Arabs. It has been the issue over which many Arab states fought wars in the past half century, mostly losing wars in which they've paid heavy prices with imprint on the psyche of generation after generation. And this remains kind of the open wound of modern Arab history.
But can that all sit on American shoulders? I mean, Americans look out and say, wait a minute, there's Arab responsibility to help bring peace here, too. And is that part of the world fully forthcoming?
No, I agree with that. I agree with that entirely. I don't think America is primarily to blame. The issue, we are discussing perceptions. Mm-hmm. We are talking about how they view the U.S. and why. And it is clear that that there are Arab responsibilities as well. And it is clear that Arab governments must play a role. It's clear that Israel has a role to play. It's clear that America has a role to play. But because of the America now is the all too powerful superpower that seems in regional minds to influence everything that goes on globally, because it is the primary supporter of Israel and they see Israeli power to be deriving from American support, clearly there is the perception that America is responsible. And so in that case, you can argue that it's a misperception, and you can argue that it's a legitimate position. Mm-hmm. But you can't argue with the fact that this is the pervasive perception that is at the core of the resentment.
Listeners, we're talking tonight with Shibli Telhami. His new book is The Stakes, America and the Middle East, The Consequences of Power and the Choice for Peace. Right. Among other things, can we ever solve the terror problem while the Israeli-Palestinian conflict goes on? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Neil is on the line. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a fabulous conversation. I appreciate Professor Telhami's point of view and insights in particular. As a reference, I am an American born in Los Angeles. I lived in Israel for 17 years,
all now right.
in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, I think, what I heard Professor Telhami say, that it's all about perceptions and transforming a sense of humiliation in the Mideast, for the Palestinians and the Mideast in general, to one of honor is paramount. And without that, there can be no real progress, either in the Israeli-Palestinian problem or the broader problem. And the question I have, or the statement of question, is my gut feeling is that not only is Israeli-Palestinian problem the prism through which many people see it, but it is a predictor of the future.
How so, Neil?
In that if you look at the international terrorism, I think the first major battle of international terrorism was staged in Munich in 1972.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in many other respects, that is the testing ground, the battleground between the Mideastern world and the Western world, and it's happening there first in many ways. And that's my perception, and I'd be happy to hear Professor Tommy's comments on that. But more importantly, whether that's true or not, how does that impact the perceptions and dealing with the broader issues? That is there something we can learn either positively or negatively from what's happening between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors, for what it could portend to the West, the United States in particular, and the Mideast?
Neil, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Shibli Telhami, I guess yeah. Neil is asking, do we see in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict the potential terrible template for what the United States might be, perhaps is, involved in?
And that actually is, I think, true in part at least. If you look at the Arab-Israeli issue and its importance for the United States, you find that it's been an axiom of American foreign policy since the mid-1970s that Arab-Israeli peace is an American interest, because if there is conflict, America has a tough time mediating between its support for Israel, which is inherent in American foreign policy, and its interest in the Arab world. And that's always been the case.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great, but you've seen this. You know what the conflict is there. How do we deal with that?
And that's a good question. And I think that the caller's point here, which I think is also important, is that if you look at that conflict and the way it has unfolded, certainly since the collapse of the Camp David negotiations in July 2000, you find that a settlement of that conflict seems less likely in the foreseeable future. More profoundly, perhaps, we see a transformation in the discourse about the conflict from a nationalist conflict to increasingly ethnic and religious conflict, which does play into the hand of a clash of civilization thesis and makes it harder to resolve. So, in fact, there is a relationship. Now, how do we do it? In my own judgment, if I had to decide on the priorities, I would say that the absolute most important priority for the United States in the Middle East in at the moment is helping bring Arabs and Israelis together to make peace. And I do think that that is not something the U.S. can impose. I don't think that the U.S. has the power to impose a peace settlement on either the Israelis or the Palestinians. But I don't think anyone else has the ability to create conditions that make peace, a negotiated peace settlement, likely.
That seems to put the U.S. in almost a kind of mythical role. I mean, if we can't impose it, and the parties there seem utterly incapable of getting to it themselves, at least right now, then we seem, as you describe it, kind of tied to the tracks with more terror coming.
In the short term, unfortunately, that I think is the reality. But I do think that when you look historically, for example, at the role of President Jimmy Carter in the first Camp David negotiations, he brought American leverage to the table. America has a lot of leverage, and it must use it in nudging the parties forward. It must use it to keep them at the negotiating table. It must use it to give them disincentives to go back to fighting. But it cannot ultimately impose the actual final agreement. It can impose a negotiated process, but it cannot impose the actual terms of the agreement.
So take some of the energy that's being put into perhaps Iraq and a lot of other efforts and focus it instead on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It sounds very daunting if that's what we have to solve the terror problem. But we take that one. What else is on your policy list? If instead of coercive force, we're going to look at policy changes, amendments, course corrections.
Well, I think when you say it's daunting, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right, because it's not daunting. If you're looking at it in terms of you want a solution tomorrow, yes, it's daunting. But if you're looking at it in terms of a process that moves forward, that creates hope, that creates possibilities, it's not daunting. I mean, in the 1990s, when you look at the 1990s, now we look at it as a failed exercise. Of course, it failed ultimately, and unfortunately it did, even though it had a chance of succeeding. But if you look at that process, flawed as it was, limited as it was, that began with the Madrid Conference from the first Bush administration into the Oslo agreements through the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. what you had was a birth of hope. There was a process in place that rejuvenated the moderates, revived them, put the militants on the defensive. And actually, when you look at that entire decade, you find that every single year, the incidence of terrorism in the region went down. And by the year 1999 or 2000, terrorism within the region went down to the lowest of any region around the world except for North America, according to our State Department reports.
And then 2001, 9/11, boom, and here we are.
Al-Qaeda is a phenomenon that I think has to be addressed, and it is connected to the Middle East, and I think the Middle East has to take action, not just America, on that one. But that is different from what we're talking about, which is the regional terrorism.
All right, so we'll calm down a bit on that and take your point that we can at least get discussions going, and that in itself would be an ameliorating factor. Rafat is on the line. Welcome, Rafat. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just want to say I have two comments, actually. Mm-hmm. One of them is a comment. Another one is I think it's a solution for the problem. Mm-hmm. The comment is, which is I agree with Professor Telahami, when he said that Islam and Muslims, they are not against modernization. The proof is from the Islamic history, and the proof is from the Muslims who are come to America to study, and mm-hmm. still they are continue with their religion and with their principles and hold tight on it.
Good point.
Without giving any like concessions or any compromising. They're not, the other point is it's like a solution, which is the American administration, I see, is forgetting or maybe ignoring the civilians, the people in the Middle East, the Muslims in general. I'm talking about the individuals that who have been ignored.
You're saying America is talking too much with leaders and not enough with the Islamic populations of the Middle East?
Exactly. They're talking with leaders. Like, it's like the other word is they are sacrificing billions of civilians who are intelligent, smart, and who have the solution in their hand. They can solve it, but they are tied with their hands because of those regimes, those corrupted regimes who are oppressing them, who are controlling their life.
Rafat, we've got it. Let me put it to Shibli Talhami, and thank you for the call. Shibli Talhami, here's another point where there's a lot of tension, I think, in the American mind. It's presented very often that as much as we might not like these authoritarian regimes, if you pull them away, you've got raging, angry Islamic fundamentalists who are going to vote out democracy and vote out America and be done with it. Our caller, Rafat, is saying, no, reach out to the Muslim Arab population, and you may have a receptive audience.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point and an important one. I think if you look at the 1990s and you say, what was the biggest mistake in the peace process, in the effort to bring about a negotiated settlement in the region? I think most of the people who are involved on all sides, I think, would agree that one of the failures, there were many, but one of the failures was that they ignored the public. That they only talked among government officials, assuming that they can deliver. And there wasn't really a campaign to bring about an engagement between the publics, to change the minds, to win the hearts, to persuade, to bring them along in the direction of peace. And I think almost everyone you ask today who was involved says that that has to be part of any new campaign. Now, in terms of the broader point pertaining to public opinion, I think it's true that in general, American foreign policy historically, and certainly in the 1990s, had been built on the assumption that public opinion in the Middle East isn't so much relevant for what happens because these governments are authoritarian. They're ultimately going to be able to control the public.
But you're saying it is. We're going to have to come back and get that, Shibli Talhami. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight. We're rethinking the American response to terrorism. Is this just another Blame America analysis of the terror problem? Can we stamp out terrorism with armies and police action? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBU.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Shibli Talhami about rethinking the American response to terrorism. He's out with a great new book, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, The Consequences of Power and the Choice for Peace. And he says we may be going about this wrong, maybe all wrong. What do you think? Are we going down the wrong path in the war on terrorism? Are we relying too much on coercive force, overlooking other options? Do you agree with Shibli Talhami that it's all about conflicting policies, not conflicting values? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shibli Talhami, you say that ultimately the United States can defeat al-Qaeda, can defeat Iraq, and still fail, still be plagued by terrorism. Why? How?
Well, let me put it this way. We are the most powerful nation on earth, and we should use our power prudently. And you know, there's no escaping that. And I think there's no question that we can bring down the Iraqi regime through war. And we can, I think, destroy much of al-Qaeda's power globally if we stay the course. I think my fear is the following. If we rely on a policy that only uses force and does not understand the question of legitimacy of terrorism in the eyes of many around the world, then we have we can run into what I call three basic problems. One is, as always, when one feels very powerful, we underestimate the limitation of power. Now, let me give you a very simple example here. Think about what happened just a couple of weeks ago when North Korea announced just suddenly that it has nuclear capabilities. And think about our response and why that response is so muted and why we're not likely to go to war with North Korea now, even though we are the greatest nation on earth and the most powerful nation perhaps in relation to other countries in the history of the state system in the world.
And you quickly see
the reason
a limitation
for it is
of
because
power
we're
there.
Focused on Iraq, obviously. And that's just a simple indication of the extent to which the limitation of power affects your policies elsewhere.
Not to mention that North Korea is a very tough nut, given the proximity of Seoul and South Korea, everything else,
certainly,
a hyperpower.
But still, but you're talking about two essentially third-world powers. You're not talking about a superpower here. I'm talking about North Korea that still is not exactly a superpower.
So you're saying we could still lose because if we rely too much on simple power projection, that won't necessarily win the day.
First, there's always the limitation of power issue that we underestimate. If we get into Iraq and then it turns out we have to keep troops, there are 75,000 troops for 5 years, it's certainly going to make it harder for us to do other things that we might want to do.
All right.
The second reason I think is more profound reason is that we always underestimate the motivational factor. The Middle East is important to us, but it's even more important to its people. And if you have motivated enemies, and if they're driven, they're willing to pay a higher price, even if they're weaker. They're willing to stay the course longer. They're willing to die much more readily than we will be down the road. Motivating enemies is something that we don't want to do. So we have to, at least whatever policy we do, even if we use force, we have to make sure that in the process we don't increase the number of motivated enemies, because motivation ultimately is a major factor that balances power.
Have we increased or diminished the number in the months since 9/11?
Have we increased or diminished the number?
If you look,
I mean, my problem is, if you ask the question today, is resentment of America in the Middle East and really in much of the world, I wouldn't say just the Middle East, is it higher today than it was before 9/11? I would say it's higher today. That's frightening to me. Second, is terrorism seen to be more legitimate or less legitimate by more people in the Middle East? I would say it's seen to be more legitimate, and that's frightening to me. And so that itself, I look as an indicator, even as I look at the reduction of the number of maybe Al-Qaeda adherents. I mean, there are two jobs here. They both must be done. It's not just one. I don't say you delegitimize it, but you don't confront the organizers.
So confront and
both.
Delegitimize. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air. Join us. Hello, David.
Hi. This is David. This is a great subject, and I'm glad that I had the chance to express my opinion.
Good to have you.
I think that we cannot get any resolution by using force, in my opinion, because if you look at through the history, anytime a powerful uses force, they can put down the resistance for a while, but eventually they're going to get it back. The best way to deal with the problem is to be just and to be fair, especially United States, which is a superpower and can do a lot more than any regime in the past or any superpower in the past could do, especially since Russia is basically gone.
But David, the terrorists came into the heart of Manhattan and destroyed two very tall towers full of people. Is it just and fair then to hit back, or is it a mistake?
I think definitely it's a great idea to go find the reason that those people did that. Most of those people were from Saudi Arabia. They belong to the ideology of Wahhabi religion, which is a minority. Most 1 billion Muslims, they're probably a small fraction of them believe in that ideology.
So what's your question for Shibli Talhami?
My question is, I have a comment. I think that it's been 45 years that we are trying to resolve the issue between Palestinian and Israelis. And I think for the leader, if there is a leader, the lack of leader in this world right now, if there was leader, they could have resolved this long time ago. We have a huge leverage on Israelis. We give them a lot of money. And I have absolutely have nothing against Israelis or Palestinian. I'm American, and I absolutely love human being. I think human being all over the place is the same. So if you've been fair to all the parties across the world, Israelis and Palestinian, I don't think we would have a problem like this. And
So it's all about fairness. David, thanks for your call. It's hard to find. The other big thing that comes up here at Shibli Tilhami is oil. And the view that maybe what we need to do is simply reduce American dependence on Saudi oil and thereby permit a kind of withdrawal from the region. And I guess the hope there is that we'd then be less vulnerable.
Well, of course, it's always a good idea to reduce your dependence on oil. That's a good in itself, whether it's Middle Eastern oil or anybody else's oil. The more independent you are, the better off. The problem is that much of this is based on wishful thinking. The Middle East is going to be more important, not less important, for the oil market. Whether we buy oil from Saudi Arabia or from Venezuela or Russia, it's still one seamless oil market. And the role of the Middle East in that oil market is huge. The pricing is very much affected by the supply and demand, but certainly by the policies of big suppliers like Saudi Arabia, which holds individually 25% of the proven oil reserves in the world. And because the Middle East accounts for about two-thirds of the world oil reserves, it is going to become more important down the road. Now, the Middle East only accounts for 25% of the production of oil. So much of the world will be running out. The Middle East will still have it.
So you're saying there's no disentangling here. So ultimately, Shibli Tilhami, you come down on the side of the United States using the openness of its culture to win the war on terror, understanding the limits to power, building bridges of understanding, and it sounds great, but can that really be done in a world where terrorists are using America's openness against it?
Absolutely, because I think that the key in fighting terrorism is to get more allies. You need more cooperation to create more stability around the world, not less stability. Terrorism thrives in instability. It's the anti-state. The states are ultimately the allies of the war on terrorism because they don't want to see this horrible phenomenon destabilize the system. So I do think that winning the hearts and minds, winning the cooperation of states, which will be based on mutual vital interest, will help reduce the phenomenon. We will never be able to eradicate the phenomenon. It's always been there historically. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is reduce it, and now there's a real danger because this phenomenon in the era of globalization is much easier. Remember, it didn't take a lot of technology to carry out 9/11. It was just fewer than a couple of dozen men with box cutters doing so much damage to the U.S. If you have people who are motivated and willing to risk their lives, they can do a lot of damage no matter what you do. It is very important to reduce the number of motivated people and to win the cooperation of others. Those people are trying to play to an orchestra. They want to be applauded. Mm-hmm. And if societies delegitimize them, as they must, that is the best way to fight terrorism down the road.
And there's the message. Look to the motivations. Shibli Tilhami, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Shibli Tilhami is author of the new book, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, The Consequences of Power and the Choice for Peace. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, the treaty to ban landmines 5 years later. This is On Point. Today marks the fifth anniversary of the Mine Ban Treaty. International outcry against the use of landmines cultivated in the 1997 signing of the treaty. Over 130 countries have signed it. The United States has not. Gina Copeland Newfield is coordinator of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines. In this radio diary, she gives her thoughts on the anniversary in light of the potential war on Iraq.
The 1997 mine ban treaty prohibits the use, trade, production, and stockpiling of anti-personnel landmines. It also provides for treaty signatories to help landmine victims and to remove landmines worldwide. It has universal appeal because this weapon is so indiscriminate, it cannot tell the difference between the foot of a child and that of a soldier. This is not just a piece of paper, but a treaty that's having a tremendous impact in the world and saving people's lives. Landmines are a horrible topic to be confronted with day in and day out in my job. However, I am thrilled to be able to work with community leaders and ordinary citizens around the country who really care about this weapon. We don't have anti-personnel landmines in our backyards, luckily for us. But nevertheless, there are so many people around this country, so many organizations, churches, synagogues, mosques, peace organizations, veterans organizations, humanitarian groups, human rights groups, who care about this issue, who have been contacting the White House. And in fact, today and tomorrow are official national White House call-in days on the landmines issue. We're urging people to call the White House and urge President Bush not to let the U.S. military use anti-personnel landmines in Iraq, and more broadly, to ban the weapon altogether. And it's really inspiring for me personally to work with so many committed activists and organizations and ordinary citizens throughout the country who really care about this weapon. They imagine their kids traveling to school or playing in a field and being blown up by this horrible weapon. In most mine-affected countries, people support their families by going to a field and cultivating their land. And when there are landmines in the ground, that's a pretty dire risk that they're taking. And in some cases, they feel they have to take that risk. So I'm inspired by the people who day in and day out live with the fear of landmines and try to make do despite this major threat in their communities. In 1997, President Clinton failed to sign the mine ban treaty, but what he did do was create U.S. policy that put our country on the path towards joining the mine ban treaty by the year 2006. And in the meantime, we would take certain steps towards accession to the treaty, such as coming up with alternatives to the weapon, getting rid of the use of landmines in U.S. war battle plans, etc. The Bush administration started a formal review of U.S. landmine policy early last year, and we are expecting them to come out with new U.S. landmine policies soon. They have not yet come out with these policies. The U.S. campaign to ban landmines is very hopeful that President Bush will see that anti-personnel landmines are more of a hindrance than a help on the modern battlefield for U.S. soldiers, and they create a humanitarian crisis in dozens of mine-affected countries throughout the world.
Gina Copeland Newfield is coordinator of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by